Mondas podcast.
Hello everybody, welcome to Mondas Podcast. This is the final episode of this run. Also, before we start, I'd just like to tell you about a convention coming up in the northeast of England. It's called ScreenCon, and it's on Saturday, 12th of October, and that's at the Park Hotel in Tynemouth. And confirmed guests include Warwick Davis, Craig Charles, and Caroline Munro, who, if you have a bit of classic knowledge of Doctor Who, she was linked to be the companion in the movie that was never made in the late 80s. So that's ScreenCon, and that's got a Facebook page as well, and an event. And that's the 12th of October. It starts at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it's $9.95 for adults and $4.95 for kids. So that's ScreenCon. Check that out. They've also got a Twitter as well. So we're going to start recommending classic Doctor Who for newbies, new kids on the block. So enjoy. Thanks very much for your time. First one I'm going to throw in the hat is going to be Curse of Fenric. I've mentioned it too many times on Mondas, but I don't think you can mention it too many times because it's brilliant. Are you a fan?
I'm a fan of that one. I'm very much a fan of Curse of Fenric. I think it's a fantastic story. It's great actors in it as well.
Yes, totally. I mean, when you think about it, you've got... Nicholas Parsons. You know, you just don't associate Nicholas Parsons with such a straight role as well, and he really plays so well.
I think that's what alarms a lot of people, especially in that particular period of Doctor, because you had a lot of stunt casting. You had like Richard Briers, it was Paradise Tales, but he wasn't fantastic in that, and he really did overplay it. That's one, and also like Ken Doss in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy as well, which this day is like scarred me mentally because he gets shot in the back. And he's just like, no, that's Ken Doss, you can't kill Ken Doss. So the stunt casting did always pay off, but when it comes to Nicholas Parsons, he knew exactly how to play it.
It was quite harrowing at the end of the day because you've got that kind of, I mentioned this the other week when I was doing a podcast. I was saying it is very pastiche of horror, you know, and you know where they come from with the fog and whatnot. But it does work. And also, must just say, I'll edit it so it makes it sound good. But it was actually Dalton the Bannerman rather than Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
I think you're right. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. Yes.
I don't want to lose any geek points. So.
No, that's all right. Don't worry.
Curse of Fenric was one of the first ever ones I actually saw as well. So it always stays in your mind much more. You're much more nostalgic, aren't you, for that sort of thing? And the setting with it being like 1940s and stuff. And I think the Dark Doctor really comes to fore in that episode, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. I mean, he's sort of, it's that whole thing with, he's playing ace, basically, isn't he? It's sort of steering us towards something. Unfortunately, we never get to find out what, really. The game plan he had for ace, and I think it was meant to be sort of going to the Academy of Gallifrey, wasn't it?
But
this is sort of like trying to get to face her past. And he does quite a bit of that in that season, to be honest. He does that in Ghostlight as well. And he sort of follows it up in this one. So I think it's really, really great. And it's the fact that, you finally see that, Ace hates her mother. And this is really Ace's story, to be honest. And it's just the way the Doctor plays her and manoeuvres her into facing her past and everything. And I like that about the Seventh Doctor.
Yeah, I think this is where they were really getting it right, after quite a lot of missteps, but they were really starting to click in the gear. It made you kind of intrigued to see where they would have went in that next season,
Yeah, it's a shame they didn't. It's a shame they never got the chance, really, because they were, as you say, they were finding their feet with stories like this.
Yeah. Another notable mention, I think, in the McCoy era is Remembrance of the Daleks as well. I think that's a story that it has two factions of Daleks. I mean, two for the price of one. You've got Davros in a kind of a cameo. It's very kind of nostalgic for lots of nods to the past and stuff of Doctor Who. And I think it's not too, I'd rather see that as the anniversary special than the Nemesis.
There's never speak of Super Nemesis,
Colin. I used to like that when I was a kid, because it was obviously one of the first ever episodes, but and then when you watch it as an adult, you think, this is a mess. You
know? It's terrible. It is awful.
Mondas. So, yeah, so what's your first one, then?
Well, as I was saying beforehand, we were, you sort of said, okay, pick your favourite five. And I ended up sort of picking ones from the first five Doctors.
Hmm.
Okay, so the first one is Edge of Destruction, which is a first Doctor story. And it's, I don't know if it's widely known. Is this one you're familiar with at all?
My first and second Doctor knowledge is shocking. And it's always something that I need to get more into. I don't know. I just don't find this that accessible sometimes.
It's a two-parter story, this one. And it's set after the Daleks.
Right.
And this story, it sets up so, like, quite a few things in sort of, one thing in particular about, in Doctor Who lore, is the fact that the TARDIS is alive, okay? And it also changes the dynamic of the TARDIS crew, because the first few stories in Hartnell's first series, he doesn't trust Ian and Barbara, and they don't trust him.
Hmm.
The first few stories, particularly in things like An Unearthly Child, where he wants to cave, the Doctor, this is, wants to cave in a Stone Age man's head with a rock, right? So, and the Doctor's not a nice character, but this story, it turns it on its head. But as I say, it's only a two-parter, and it was written really, really hurriedly, just so they could get a 13-episode season or series. Series. So this is written in a real hurry as like a filler story. But just sort of that accident, they can't, the whole thing about the TARDIS is alive. Because the whole thing is that the TARDIS is returning or heading back to the beginning of time. And the TARDIS is trying to give people, give them all clues as to that something's really, really wrong. And basically they're heading towards, you know, destruction. The TARDIS will destroy itself. And there's like really weird things in there with, like, they've got this great big ornate clock in there. It begins, and the clock face melts. It's like a Dali painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it all starts to melt, and it's trying to sort of give them clues to start to say there's something wrong with time. But all throughout this, they think that the Doctor thinks that Ian and Barbara has sabotaged the TARDIS. And it just ups the ante with the whole distrust amongst them all. And it's just them. It's just them on the TARDIS set. They don't land any other planets. There's no other actors in it. It's just like the four core actors from the TARDIS group. And it's just a fantastic story. But there was one other really controversial thing as well, because they all go a bit loopy.
Hmm.
And Susan walks around with like a pair of scissors to like threaten to stab people. Right. So. And after that, they vowed they would never, ever do anything like that again.
Hmm.
They wouldn't have any of the sort of the heroes threaten to stab someone.
Yeah.
It wasn't really the educational program they were sort of going for there, was it?
No, it went a bit mental, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But basically, and at the end of it all, they all sort of like apologise to one another. They form more of a bond at the end of it. And that's where it takes the series forward, where they sort of trust each other a lot more. And
so I was going to ask you, is it available as just a one-off DVD, or is it part of a box or something?
It's part of the box set. I think it's called The Beginning.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
Box set, yeah. But if you can, I mean, I'd say there's other ways you can get a hold of this story, but I'll recommend that to anybody, because it is a fantastic, tense story. And it sets up a little bit of TARDIS, the TARDIS lore about the fact it's alive and it's self-aware. I just love it for that fact. And I didn't know about it for years because, my partner knowledge was pretty thin on the ground to begin with. And, you know, thanks to the DVDs and what's left of these stories, I'm discovering all these things. And I had seen the destruction, but it was a long, long time ago. And so I saw it again for the first time about a couple of years back, and I thought, what a fantastic story this is.
Yeah,
and
it sounds interesting, very experimental, but you saw it is. Me anyway, so, you know.
There's a lot of weird stuff goes on in it. It's really good, really good.
I think Moffat sounds like he's been very, very kind of influenced by that sort of episode, because in little moments of stuff you've just said there, you can kind of trace in the new series as well.
Oh yeah, you can. Mm. You can. There's some other things that sort of retrofitted come in, because they sort of there's a bit in this one where Ian checks the Doctor's heart, not his heart. That doesn't come up till Spread from Space, when you get the first mention of hearts.
Right.
Yeah. So they sort of try to. I think they try to explain it away somehow by saying that the. I think it was a novel. So I don't know what the name of the novel is, unfortunately. But they tried to explain about the Doctor didn't grow second heart to be regenerated into the second Doctor.
Yes.
but there's that whole thing of, you know, is it canon and all that, so which I'd rather not get bogged down in.
No, totally not. But the next one is definitely canon, and it's to celebrate the episode, and it's five Doctors. And
hey.
Some people don't like it, but to me, it's like a greatest hits package, and it's brilliant. And if you have any sort of knowledge of, actually, even if you don't have knowledge, it's still a very kind of celebratory, and you'll enjoy, because it's basically all the best moments, best baddies and stuff all into one. And I can tell by your way you're a fan as well.
I am. I love this story. I mean, I remember watching it in 83, and I skipped Air Cadets to stay in and watch this. Right, so I got into trouble for it, but I thought, sod it. I mean, that's the days before. I mean, we didn't have a video recorder back then. I think we were one of the only few families that didn't have a video recorder, so there was no way I was going to miss this. And I love it. I absolutely love it. It has got its detractors now, so it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a mess. It's one of those hurried stories, isn't it? It was rewritten from a Robert Holmes sort of first draft. And Terence Dick rewrote it, and I think he's done a perfectly good job.
Yeah, you if you didn't know the origins of what happened and stuff, you wouldn't guess, because it's got everything. At the end of the day, if you were to try and write with all the different Doctors and all the different combinations and stuff, and trying to shoehorn different bits in 90 minutes, it's not easy, you know.
It's not easy. But I do like the whole thing of, you know, the sort of the quest they have to go on and everything in the death zone and all that. And I think it's great, and it's got one of the best and most simple monsters ever. That's the Raston warrior robot.
Well, I'd love to see him back. He's brilliant.
Oh, that was fantastic. such a simple idea. And apparently that section was directed by Jonathan Turner.
Wow.
So
talented.
Yeah, I know. And he
co-wrote Dimensions in Time. So
let's forget about that one.
Five Doctors is brilliant, and if you want to check that out, it's been released in a special edition before and stuff with added bits and stuff, but ultimately I think it is it's what everyone would want from this year's anniversary special, if they're honest. But you could never repeat something as crazy as that, you know.
Multi-Doctor stories, it's a difficult thing to pull off.
Very difficult.
It really is, especially back then they were trying to do all five Doctors. Well, it was only four, really, because Tom Baker didn't want to take part in it. But for the most part, and also one of your lead actors is dead.
Yeah.
So they certainly cast him. I thought he was okay, Richard Herndon.
I'll be honest with you, I enjoyed it, but he ate sandwiches very oddly. I don't know what it was about it. I think it was either Harry or Leeson from Russell and Men noticed it as well. If you watch back, he has a weird way of eating.
Oh, no, it wasn't a sandwich, it was a slice of pineapple.
It was creepy.
He sort of picked up and nibbled on it like a mouse. It's really peculiar. That made me laugh, because when we did a Coventry for Life podcast about 2 years ago for Five Doctors, and it's that bit where they he packs off Tegan to make the tea, right? And it's sort of like the Fifth Doctor's like, you know, just assume him. And when he comes back, they make me tea. They've turned the TARDIS into a Wham video. But it's like Club Tropicana in there. And there's all these like cocktails and, as I say, bits of pineapple for the First Doctor to nibble on. And it's really peculiar, but it's so 80s as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, he did all right at the end of the day. You know, you weren't expecting him to be exactly the same. So, you know, it's like, what can you do in that sort of instance? Yeah. So, you know.
What I did like about it was that it was the first Doctor that solved the problem. And I thought that was only right, to be honest.
Well, I like Davison, but at the end of the day, he's never going to be the main man, is he? He's always kind of helping things along, but he's not going to like jump in and take control like Tom Baker anything.
Yeah,
so it was always going to be someone else, wasn't it?
Yeah,
take the lead. You know,
I think the only downside to that is the fact you don't get enough of the Doctors together.
Yeah. I don't know if that was other people could make at the same time and stuff, and they were trying to sync them all up. I don't know, but...
Well, so rumour has it, it was Jonathan Turner engineered it that way because he didn't think all their egos in the same room would work. but when they filmed the last scene and they were all together, and you could see how well it did work, he regretted it afterwards.
Right.
Yeah, I was sort of regretted that bit, really, because I thought that just to see them all together at the end was fantastic.
Oh, totally. It was amazing. Yeah. So what's your next on your list, then?
Well, my one, it's a Patrick Troughton story. It's the last Patrick Troughton story, The War Games.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm recommending anything to anybody, this is probably, it's a 10-part story, this one. It's a long story to get stuck into. But, it's another story that sets up a lot of stuff about the Doctor. Because this has got the first mention of the Time Lords. It's got the first mention of the first appearance of the message cubes that you saw in The Doctor's Wife. Yeah, so it sets up loads of things like that. But it also sets up the Time Lords. And it's the one only time they set up the Time Lords as a force to be reckoned with. Because the Doctor is absolutely petrified of involving them at the end. And I mean, basically, what it is, they land on this planet that's got different time zones, and it all look like wars. So you've got like the First World War, you've got Roman times, you've got this American Civil War, and it's been engineered by these like more renegade Time Lords. And basically, the Doctor's sort of trying, and it goes on, say, for 10 parts, so they do go from one zone to the other, and the people in these zones don't know they've been plucked out of time and dumped into these different zones. And you've got other time machines, and it's all called, it's spelled Sidrats, but pronounced Sidrats, which is based on the inversion of the word TARDIS.
Right. Yeah.
So that they're all going about. But when the Doctor calls in the Time Lords, basically sort of like, you do not mess with these people, right? They're actually meant to be like a terrifying force. And you actually, when I watched it for the first time, for a very, very long time, last year, I just forgot how much they actually built them up. And when you do see them, when the Doctor's trying to escape from them again, because he realised if he calls them back, they're going to catch him up and they want to catch him for nicking the TARDIS, basically. So basically, they slow time down so you can't get to his TARDIS and things like that. And they're so powerful. But every time they sort of come, their presence is felt. It's sort of like a rumbling noise all the time. So it's sort of like there's like a massive force coming towards you. And it's so well done. And it's sort of like, and you do feel like you know why the Doctor's running away from them.
Because later on, the Time Lords are kind of like, hello, you know, they're all kind of rumbling posh people. You know?
Old duffers, aren't they, basically? Yeah, it's sort of old duffers. I mean, I think next to the Time Lords, in actually the two Doctors, when they're sort of trying to control the... Omega's black hole.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
With the antimatter of the universe. So that's the next time you see them. And they're not really a force to be reckoned with. There's sort of a lot of poking around with futuristic bits of paper, which is in the shape of hexagon, I think. And it's just sort of, they're very, again, that bureaucratic thing's coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, by the time you get the deadly assassin, that's what they say, it's a load of old duffers who you sort of expect to be running a library, not lots of time.
Like a lot of things around this sort of era, War Games is seen as being a bit overlong and a bit kind of, but it's seen as also like a game changer as well, isn't it? You know,
it is.
Really changes things, yeah.
Big time. I'd really recommend people. It's a long slog to get through, but I'd really recommend it to someone to watch, because if you've watched the new series, you can see where a lot of things come from. in this, because you first mentioned the Time Lords, you've got the message cubes and everything. So, and you realise why the Doctor is really petrified of getting the Time Lords involved again. But he has to. That's the whole thing. He's back to him to put, needs their help to put things right. And that's what, and that, again, it, I mean, Patrick Troughton, again, I think he's such a fantastic Doctor as well. And
I was also going to say as well, my vote goes for Invasion, and that's quite a long episode, about 7 parts, isn't it? Is that right?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. But that again, and another one which I was going to put forward as well, but I'll just put as a notable mention, Mind Robber.
Yeah.
I like that because it's mental and it's very weird, and it goes through all these different weird sort of, like, people from history, people from fiction in it and stuff, and it's... Yeah, that's quite crazy. But yeah, I was just going to say, Invasion is iconic because it sets up kind of the template of UNIT and whatnot, and it's in modern day, and you got this classic St. Paul sequence with the Cybermen.
Yeah.
And it's just. I mean, I'm not massively into the first and second Doctor, but I've obviously seen Invasion, and for people who are interested, it's also got a bit of animated. Is it one or two episodes on it?
Two episodes.
And it works, doesn't it, as well?
Oh, it's so well done.
Yeah.
so well done. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is definitely one to recommend. Even if it's an incomplete story and you're watching a lot of animation, but it doesn't take you out of it at all, does it?
No, apparently it was quite expensive, so I think that's why it doesn't take you out of it. It's quite expensive to do, because it does look good, you know. Because, I mean, when things are all in animated or whatever, you would be a bit like, But when you've got, like, say, 5 out of 7 is actually there and stuff, so it's totally different.
But I say, the Invasion, though, I mean, you've got a fantastic bad guy in it as well. And you've also got the best sniveling henchman in it as well. I can't remember. Remember what the names are. I've got a complete blank now. My geek points are rapidly depleting.
Nicholas Courtney's in it as well, isn't he?
He is indeed, yeah. The first instance of being Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart as well, because before that he was the Doctor and known as Colonel Lethbridge Stewart. So, it was just a fantastic thing. You also had the... a lot of us as well, the unit had that, what's we call it, the mobile base on the aircraft as well. And it did make UNIT feel like an international organisation.
Because I imagine that they didn't have, again, like normal, they didn't have that much of a budget, but it looked good, you know. It genuinely did look good. It didn't look, like, cheap, anything.
No, it didn't. No, it certainly didn't. Yeah. No, it was brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. Tobias Vaughan, there you go.
That's it.
God, how could I forget Tobias Vaughan?
That's such a Bond name as well, isn't it, you know?
Well, he acted like a Bond villain as well. That's what I liked about it.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I could remember the name of the, he's henchman. I can't remember the... Packer, that was it. Because it's the way he said it. It was always sneering, sort of Packer. it was fantastic, but Packer, it was like a Bond henchman as well.
Totally, he
took great pleasure in beating people up, but it was as thick as 2 sugar planks. He was just an incredibly violent man.
Well, you've got to have that from time to time, Doctor Who, you know, come on.
Exactly. The next one you won't be shot with, my next one's The Demons.
Oh, that's all right, yeah, I love The Demons. Yeah,
yeah. I think it's a classic Third Doctor story. Usually when I want to pick a Third Doctor story, I usually go for something out of Season 7. And it's usually Inferno. I love Inferno. But I thought, okay, let's try and move. I've got to move on from Inferno, so I've got to leave it behind. You know, so let's talk with The Demons, because it was one I remember most from when I was a kid. I'm not that old. I didn't watch it in 1971. But, you know, when it repeated as part of the Five Faces of Doctor Who, back in the 80s. So I've been watching that then, and I loved it. I absolutely loved The Demons. It's just a fantastic Third Doctor story. You've got him championing science against superstition and black magic, or supposed black magic, and you've got a wild witch in it. You've got the Master as a vicar. You know, you've got a gargoyle that comes alive. You've got this alien being that looks like the devil. And even sort of like that, and you've got, like, you know, Delgado's Master doing, summoning the devil, in doing black magic rituals. and stuff. And apparently it was quite controversial at the time, and probably now to Pete Marston a little bit tame, but it just cracks along at a really good pace. I think it's a fantastic story. And you've got Unit in all their pomp as well. It's got it features a lot of Bears and a lot of Captain Yates as well. You've got the classic line, you know, small chap with wing, five rounds rapid for the Brigadier.
I love that force field as well around the village
The heat barrier. Yeah, that's fantastic. but then you've got, Morris dancing as well.
Of course, and BBC Three as well.
Yes, they force it on BBC Three, yeah. I just like the fact in this as well, you've got this live sort of broadcast from an archaeological dig.
Hmm.
And I can't remember if they ever used to do that sort of thing back then on the BBC.
No, I don't think so. It reminded me very much of, it was very Hammer. It reminded me of stuff like The Devils and stuff like that, that sort of early 70s era of like horror. That was a little bit mystical and a bit weird, you know, like Wicker Man, basically, you know.
Well, it was also a little bit, Quatermass as well.
Yeah,
it's a bit like Quatermass in the Pit, because obviously it was like an archaeological, archaeological dig, and they released some sort of evil that was hidden in this cavern. It's a great story. It's absolutely great.
I was going to say, you're obviously a big Pursuit fan as well. What other ones would you throw in the hat other than the one I'm going to pick?
I would say Inferno,
yeah.
Because I think it's a cracking story. I wouldn't admit that the big sort of hairy monsters in it are just added in just for the fact of having a hairy monster, giving the kids something to hide behind the sofa from. But the actual story itself about, you know, drilling to the Earth's core and the parallel universe thing where it's already happening and it's like the end of the world. And the way it's done, it's so bleak and there's no soundtrack in it either. It's a really experimental story. And you've got like the sort of evil versions of, it's like a Big Brother version of Unit. So you've got like the Brigadier with like, he's now a brigade leader and he's got an eye patch and a scar across his eye and he's an absolute bastard. You know, it's fantastic. It's a great story. And all you've got is this like industrial noises in the background. That's your soundtrack. It's fantastic.
Mondas Podcast. Mondas Podcast.
Well, my next one, Sea Devils, and talking about soundtracks, that's got possibly the weirdest soundtrack in Doctor Who history, I think. I love it, but it...
Same here.
You know, it still is like a synthesizer having a breakdown, which I, you know, I'll copyright that quote because I said it before, but it's brilliant, you know, and it's mental sounds, but I think it really works, and I love the way it's located and stuff like that, and the master's typically evil, and I don't think the Silurians were done that well when they came back, so I don't know if I'd want the Sea Devils coming back. Personally, I don't know, in the new series.
I think they probably ruined them, because they ruined them in Warriors of the Deep.
Ooh, yeah.
And they ruined the Silurians there as well, actually. But, as they were back then, it was fantastic. I mean, that was the other great thing about the Sea Devils as well. They weren't the slow, lumbering monsters either. They would, like, run around and sort of pounce on you.
Hmm.
And they had sort of... I think that was Stuart Fell. I think that was his first gig on Doctor Who. Right. I don't know if you ever noticed that there's a really little sea devil, and that's him. And there's that scene where one gets shot, he does his great forward flip as he gets shot as well. And that was him. He was really selling himself. So that seems sort of like one. All the other sea devils just sort of like fall to the ground, but not him. He just throws himself through the air. So that's it. I think he also doubled for Katie Manning climbing down that jet onto that boat. So
I must admit, I like the Bond element of a lot of poetry, you know, the kind of going on different types of transport and stuff, and it was cool, wasn't it? Do you know what I mean?
It was cool. I mean, actually, funny you say that, when I was a kid, it was the very first issue of Doctor Who magazine, and I'll never forget this. It was obviously Tom Baker was the Doctor then.
Yeah.
And if anyone's got it, it's the one, I can remember what it was. It's a picture of Tom Baker, and he's leaning on it's like a publicity photograph, and he's on a Dalek.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And inside it had a little breakdown of each Doctor. And when it comes to the third Doctor, it always stuck with me, and that's what made me want to see more Pertwee, because he's the first Doctor I can remember. watching when I was a kid, and it said it was James Bond style action, mm-hmm. right? And I thought, I've got some of that. And it's true, though, because it was all gadgets and different cars and any sort of vehicles. Like, even had a gyrocopter in mind, which is like James Bond at one point.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to check out his final episode, Planet of Spiders, that really is like, he's basically on, it's like Planes, Trains and Automobiles. He's on every single type of transport you can get his hands on.
Well, it was, I mean,
it, you know?
Oh, yeah, well, it was just a perk, mate, weren't he? Just sort of like, let's give him one final chase. His entire episode was one big chase, wasn't it?
Yeah, basically. And I enjoyed it for that, you know?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, I love it when the doctor and the master always like nearly have a fight, you know, and they always kind of like have a sword fight and stuff. That I love that element.
Oh, the sword fight's excellent. Yeah, especially when Pertwee stops to have a sandwich. It's sort of, it always gives me an appetite like that. He has this quick sandwich. It's brilliant. Having this to your last podcast, probably one of the most popular ones and ones that some will always go for because it's such an iconic story. So I had a bit more of a think about it. And I think one that, again, it's an iconic story. I think it's overlooked and it seems of doom.
Right. I was going to mention that when we're talking about, I'm trying to think what I was talking about. Yeah, it's the guy on the big organ. He's brilliant.
Yes, Symphony for the Plants.
Yeah, because he's a proper baddie. You know, I wouldn't say Bond baddie, but he's pretty over the top and quite evil. You know.
Yeah, well, Harrison Chase is the bad guy's name. Yeah, what a fantastic name. Now the actors were Tony Beckley. The only other thing I've known from is from he played Camp Freddy in The Italian Job.
Right.
That's the only thing I actually know him from. So. To see him in this, playing absolutely evil. And this really weird thing as well, he always had leather gloves on. It was like a Bond villain. He always wore leather gloves, which you can't seem to buy anywhere. Where did you get these leather gloves from? But I just love it. I mean, it starts, again, it's like, it is like another Quatermass story again. Again, it starts out in Antarctica. And on a budget, I think it looks fantastic.
It does, yeah.
It really does look fantastic. So there you've got, and it sort of moves over to like a stately home where you've got like, you know, the bad guy, Harrison Chase, and he's with his Symphony for the Plants and all that. It's just fantastic. I don't think Tom Baker's been better.
No. I was listening to a podcast recently and they were saying he was a little bit arsey in that episode. And he did have times where Tom Baker's character was a little bit abrupt with Sarah, you know. You know, another thing I was going to say, you've got Boyce from Only Fools and Horses in it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Scorby, yeah.
But Killer Plants, you know, and they could have been really shitty, but they weren't. They were pretty unsettling, you know.
It was unsettling because that's a big thing, I think, in the film Hinchcliffe era, because they go on about the gothic horror. In his era of Doctor Who, but there's also a lot of body horror in his era as well. Because you had Ark in Space, where you had the people being turned into the Wirren, and they sort of turned into it was bark rap and everything. But I would make no apologies for it. I think it looked, for its day, I think it looked really good because and it's suddenly been taken over by this stuff. And if you read the Target novelisation of the Ark in Space, it is unbelievably gory.
All right.
There's a bit where when the guy's been sort of possessed by the Wirren and he's slowly turning into a big maggot thing. And basically, this is a bit where he said his sort of final transformation, his head splits open, right? And it goes on about all these sort of like fluids and stuff. And I thought, wow, you could not get away with that on television.
No, you'd be
pushing it now, let alone back then.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You know. But the whole thing, I think that's why the Doctor's really arsey, and it's again the same sort of era again, it's with Pyramids of Mars. He's really arsey in that one because he knows just how dire the situation is. And I think
he's happy all the time.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing, and it brings out that alien nature about the Doctor.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by stupid humans who don't understand what they're doing and what they're messing with. And I think that's why he's arty with everybody. But that's what I liked about Tom Baker's Doctor. One minute he could be like fooling around, and the next thing he'll be sort of chewing your head off.
Hinchcliffe's era, when you look back, it was amazing, you know, but by the same token, I think he got away with a lot, and after that, people like Graham Williams and all, I had to really just deal with the kind of tone it down and make it more comedic, and it was never going to be as horror-based and quite unsettling at times. You know, they had their moments after that, but, you know, it was never the same, was it?
No, it wasn't. No. This is one of the sort of stories that got Mary Whitehouse into a right bar. I think they were just trying to sort of, I don't know if they're trying to pander to her or not, I couldn't remember public opinion went in the other direction.
Hmm.
I don't know, but, I mean, this is what was classed the golden era of Doctor Who. The Philip Hinchcliffe era, and I think it's well deserved. And I think the Seeds of Doom is one of the highlights of that era, and I would recommend that story to anybody.
Tons of Wen Chiang, and you know, what can you say? Victorian setting. You've got a creepy doll called Mr. Sin, who's got a knife and he's going to kill you, and he's weird and horrible.
They'll make that a bit of a pig, the Peking Homunculus. What a fantastic name.
I mean, yes, the rat is a little bit... No, it's not a little, it's very ropey, you know. The rat in the sewer is pretty bad. But
all I'm going to say about that, if anyone's listening and thinks, right, I'm going to buy the Talons of Wen Chiang, if you leave aside the, how can I put it, the racism... aspect side to it, because you've got a white actor done up as a Chinese person.
Mm.
But if you put that to one, actually put it in the context of when it was made. To be honest. But anyway, if you watch a documentary on there about the making of this story, and they show you building the rat in the workshop, and before they put the cover on, it looks really good.
Mm.
It does look really good. And even then they admit themselves is when they put the fur on it, and it lost all of its menace, because it didn't look like rat fur.
No.
It doesn't look like a cuddly toy, doesn't it?
So. It does, yeah. It's just a big cuddly toy, you know. Generation game. But that setting is just so perfect for Tom Baker, dressed as Sherlock Holmes, and, you know, and you've got Leela's, like, reveling, kind of getting all violent and stuff, and it's a very eerie time, and I think everything was just perfectly done, you know, and obviously, I'm trying to think what they're called again, the two guys have now got their own big finish.
Oh, God.
Yeah, the guy who ran the theatre and the other guy. They were very good.
Jay Gowan Blackfoot, there you go, yes. I just remembered it.
Obviously, Robert Holmes as well wrote it, and, you know, obviously everyone... But anyone who doesn't know, Robert Holmes did mostly brilliant stuff on Doctor Who.
And he loved writing double acts as well.
Yeah, he was big on the double acts. And,
Jay Gowan Blackfoot are. So, brilliant. I totally agree. It's a fantastic story.
If you get past the casting element and stuff, and just take it for the time, it was wrong. But, you know, but if you just look at the story, it's Tom Baker totally in his pomp. You know,
there's only one thing I would probably say about the cast of John Bennett as Lee Sen Chang is the fact he doesn't. He tries not to do a caricature of that. That's about the only thing you could probably say in his defence in this day and age, anyway. And at the end, he's quite a sort of sympathetic character, because when he does get half chewed to death by the cuddly rat, and spends his dying moments in an opium den. So I mean,
we've all been there.
So you've had a great night out, you get chewed over by a cuddly rat, you end up in an opium den.
It's Urshock, by the way, that you're going to see, so I'm just precursing it. And there's another one around this time, Resurrection of the Daleks as well, which was seen to be quite violent. It was quite a violent time, wasn't it, the Fifth Doctor era near the end?
It was, wasn't it? It really was. When especially when Eric Stoke got his hands on all the scripts. He loved the bloodbath, that bloke, didn't he?
You know, everyone obviously who was into classic series will always associate Adric with Urshock, won't they? You know, the end of Adric.
It was the end of Adric. It was also featured probably one of the most strangest pieces of casting ever, and that is Beryl Reed. which this day and age, I mean, she's still It still baffles me why, but I do love this story. And I think, really, if you've never seen it before, and this is going to be an awkward thing now, because we're going to be sending this to people who never watched these stories. And it's the oh, dear. I'm a bit torn as to give it away, really, as to who the bad guys are.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's some mysterious baddies in it. And, yeah. They're underground and stuff. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's probably best not to ruin it for people. That's probably good. And don't look at the front cover of the DVD either.
No, because I think you should watch this as people watched it in 1982, and that is not knowing what the hell this story was about, to be honest.
That's going to be quite a difficult task for people, but nonetheless, it's. I think it's definitely one of Davidson's best, and I think everyone knows about the whole why it's iconic in terms of Adric. Obviously, once you watch it, you'll realise what importance he has on the story. And,
yeah.
And there's some baddies. The baddies are very good in it, and I think the baddies in it weren't that good after that, to be honest with you.
No, they've never been as good as this.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah, because there's guns. There's always guns in this era. So, especially Resurrection of the Daleks, where it's just shoot him from like that, shoot everyone, you know.
Well, I think the opening shot of the first episode of that Dalek story, you got the Litton's men as the policeman.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's a recurring character in a later story for Colin Baker?
Yeah,
Attack of the Cybermen. It's sort of they're sort of shooting these coppers not shooting people with like silenced machine guns, and it's just sort of wow, you know.
It's a bit weird having that sort of thing of the police and that sort of represented that way, you know.
Yeah, especially back in that particular. Yeah, period as well.
There was a few riots and whatnot around that era, and you know.
Yeah.
Earthshock, I think, is an iconic episode, and it's it was a bit of a random casting, I'll give you that, with Beryl. I didn't know who Beryl Reed was, but I was a bit like, what? That's a bit odd. but just to go final bits, Davison era, I would throw Enlightenment in the hat as well, in terms of a good Davison.
Because that's sort of part of the final story in the trilogy, is what they call the Black Guardian trilogy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it might not make too much sense with regards to what Turlough's doing.
Well, Terminus doesn't make any sense anyway.
No, it doesn't. So. No, that is a weird story, that one. That really is bizarre.
But yeah, I mean, you can get the trilogy relatively cheap, and Mordred Undead's good as well, so, you know.
Well, yeah, but that brings back... not one, but two brigadiers from different time zones as well.
Yes.
So it introduces Turlough into the mix as well. And it's quite a good story.
Mm.
It is quite a good story. These sort of people sort of like being cursed with sort of immortality, but they just want to die.
Yeah,
that's the whole thing of the story. They just want to die at the end. It's a peculiar story, but I mean, it's one definitely one to watch. And Enlightenment. The whole thing of a ship race in space is big, you know, with these bored elementals who just... It's a really great story. Plus, it's also got Lee John from Imagination in it as well.
It's a clever story, and I like it's, when they soup up the effects on the DVDs as well. I like the CGI stuff. It looks good. You know, the ship looks really good.
Well, I don't actually mind the original effects, to be honest.
No.
I still quite like it. I do like a nice bit of model work in Doctor Who, I've got to be honest.
And also, it seems probably best to say this at the end as well. If you want to ignore all the stuff that we've just said and actually just watch the first and last, you could watch Unearthly Child and Survival.
You could do.
The first ever and the last ever classic, because I think they're both good in their own way. So I think Survival is a good story that's led down by poor costume in terms of the cat people.
Yes.
Apart from that, it's a good story, and it looks nice. The planet looks really cool. I like
it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
And Unearthly Child is where it all started. So, and obviously we've got this Mal Gatiss documentary coming, docudrama coming, just around the anniversary, which will go into the origins of the show as well. So that probably is a good, the beginnings box set that you mentioned before.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
It's definitely somewhere to start. Definitely. It's... I'd say Yeah, I don't know if he chose it, because that sets out... You can see how the Doctor has changed. Because the story arc at Edge of Destruction, that shows the change in the First Doctor.
Yeah.
And if you watch an Unearthly Charles, you can see he was more of an anti-hero than a hero. The hero of the piece is really Ian Chesterton.
Isn't it such an exciting thing to be able to think that you don't know all this knowledge and you can then go and watch all the stuff. Such a privileged position, isn't it?
It is. I actually envy people. Having never seen these before and discovering for the first time.
Well, do you want to tell the new people who are listening or just general people how they can find out about you on Twitter and your podcast, etc.?
Yeah, sure. I'm from a podcast called the Who's Eat Podcast. You can find our website at who's-he-podcast.co.uk. You can find our podcast on iTunes just by searching Who's Eat Podcast, and we're also on Twitter. If you just search for who's_he_podcast.
Mondas podcast.